From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Horror is a kind of high, says Margie Kerr, who researches how our brains respond to things that scare us. Horror movies and haunted houses are bursts for our paleo brains to feel empathy and, at least for a moment, forget about doing laundry or paying bills. So today, we're going all in for Halloween. We'll introduce you to some famous Georgia ghosts and learn about the history of zombie lore. But first, a journey through the haunted pink trap house. Atlanta rapper 2 Chainz attracted visitors from all over when he opened the place. Now he's scaring up even more frights with the help of some collaborators. On Second Thought, producer LaRaven Taylor ventured behind the scenes and now is taking you along.
My name is Alan Glover. I'm the owner of 13 Stories Haunted House here in Noonan, Georgia. The 2 Chainz crew reached out to us, which is the street execs, and wanted to do a hip-hop themed haunted house. So we thought that'd be a great idea once we met a couple times, and it went from there. It's the trap house, the haunted pink trap house, with eyes wide open. We want them to realize that we're trying to present a message. Yeah, we're trying to be scary, we're trying to be haunted, but we want you to learn something when you go into the haunted house. We want you to go through and realize the trap lifestyle may not be for you. And we also want people to understand that trap nowadays, like 13 Stories is my trap. It's where you make your money. The 2018 version is totally different than it used to be. So, you know, the DJ that we have every night, that's his trap. That's how he makes his money. The candy lady, that's how she makes her money. So we want everybody to understand it's all in fun. It's all entertainment. You know, we've had people pee their pants. I mean, that happens pretty regularly. And last weekend, we had about 2 people lose a shoe.
Oh, my gosh.
You mix in certain songs from 2 Chainz into certain areas. Like in the cemetery, we have Free Base. It kind of has that scary feel to it. And then in the Zombie Kill, we have El Chapo, we have some, you know, you just want to theme each song based on the scene the best you can. And then also we have some of the 1980s and 90s hip-hop movies, Boys in the Hood, Set It Off, Menace to Society, Juice, some of those that we kind of incorporated in as well. I'm the king of the trap, El Chapo, anywhere
on the map. My name is Lisa Taylor. I'm a crowd pleaser. I have several that, you know, are very in your face, a lot of running. I usually blend in to the surroundings and make men usually just kind of vibrate just a little. I've been punched in the chest a couple of times. That's the craziest, but usually it's the running. You know, once they see you, they take off.
My name is Erin Meyer. I am a makeup artist as well as I act and help with operations. She is going to be working in the study tonight, so she is a ghoul girl.
My name is Alan Simone. I'm from Atlanta, Georgia. Visiting the trap house today. It was amazing, and it was a place I loved to be. I expected to see a lot, be scared, and experience the trap. I believe it brings everybody together to come out, experience fun, you know, laughter, see what the trap is really about. See that, you know, it's different outlets for the trap nowadays.
Already know, got trapped for the year 4 times in a row. LaRaven Taylor brought us that audio postcard from the Haunted Trap House. The attraction is open through November 11th. For Halloween, GPP host Ricky Bevington turns from news stories to ghost stories. She and producer Sophia Salaby have unearthed haunting tales of Georgia's most memorable spirits. They started in the southwest Georgia town of Americus. There, the spirits of a little girl and her mother are said to haunt the halls of the Windsor Hotel.
The brand new Windsor Hotel in 1892 is the height of luxury for celebrities and politicians escaping cold northern winters. The red brick Victorian building features towers, balconies, elevators, and a three-story atrium lobby. It is the only hotel in Georgia offering guests individualized silverware. Legend has it that one day in the early 1900s, a housekeeper named Emily May was arguing with her lover in the hotel's third floor hallway. As the couple's exchange grew heated, her young daughter Emma stood by helplessly, holding her mother's hand. In a fit of rage, Emily May's lover pushed her furiously into a nearby elevator. What he may not have realized, the elevator shaft was empty. Mother and daughter, still hand in hand, fell three stories to their deaths. Since that tragic day at the Windsor Hotel, guests and employees report feeling the presence of a little girl. Some hear a child's footsteps running down a third floor hallway. Guests also confess to seeing the fleeting reflection of a woman in a long black dress in a third floor mirror. Pots and pans fly off tables and counters. Lights and radios mysteriously turn on and off. Today, the Windsor Hotel embraces its spooky history with ghost tours to introduce guests to Emily May and Emma. If you go to the Windsor, you can also look for the spirit of a former doorman wandering the building, still welcoming guests to their stay.
This next ghost story comes from Roswell, where a love story ended in tragedy at the height of the Civil War.
In 1864, times were tough in Roswell, occupied by federal troops under Union General William Tecumseh Sherman. Food and clothes were expensive and hard to come by. One of the only places to get what you needed was the commissary, the general store. A teenager named Catherine worked for her father, who owned the commissary. One day, a young Union soldier named Michael walked in to pick up a few things. He spotted Catherine, and it was love at first sight. An affair between a northerner and southerner was scandalous. Their relationship was short. Michael was charged with treason and was hanged in the Roswell town square. It is said Catherine witnessed the execution from the upstairs window of the commissary. Her heart broke. A few days later, Catherine was found dead, hanging from the large beams of the upstairs floor of the commissary. In recent years, the commissary has been home to several failed restaurants, and according to reports, the spirits of the couple still linger. Employees said the grand piano sometimes played by itself. In the morning, they would come upstairs to see chairs move to clear a space in the center of the room. And people swear they've seen ghostly figures in the upstairs windows of the commissary dancing in each other's arms. So it seems Catherine and Michael have been reunited in the afterlife. Thank you.
Dead last is this tale from Lawrenceville. There, the ghost of a man wrongfully put to death is said to still be heard singing to the love he left behind.
What we know of this story comes from Judge Richard D. Wynn, who confessed to his part in the tragedy some 40 years earlier. Wynn's 1883 article in the Gwinnett Herald begins by describing Colonel James Austin as a drunk. One night in 1848, Austin burst into his kitchen to find a married slave couple working, Ellick and Betsy. Austin grabbed Betsy. Ellick fought back, tearing Austin off his wife. Enraged, Austin chased his slave while wildly swinging a sword. Ellick scrambled into a cabin loft. Cornered and fearing for his life, Ellick fatally stabbed his master 9 times in self-defense. As Austin lay dead before him, Ellick chose not to run. He went straight to the courthouse to explain the unfortunate death of Colonel James Austin. Instead of being rewarded for his honesty, Judge Wynn sentenced Ellick to hang. Writing almost 4 decades later, Wynn questions whether Ellick's punishment fit his crime, asking, quote, "If it had been a free man, would it not have been classed as justifiable homicide?" Today, tour guides bring visitors into the historic Lawrenceville jail. They point to indentations in the back of one cell where Ellick may have tried to carve his way to freedom. There are reports of unexplained orbs of light, missing audio recordings of tours, and a feeling of deep sorrow when you lean on the walls of the cell. Often, when tour guides sing the same mournful song Ellick sang for his wife from jail, they hear a voice singing with them, echoing back the last words of each phrase. Betsy, will you meet me? Betsy, will you meet me? Betsy, will you meet me in heaven above? Happy Halloween.
GPB Atlanta host Ricky Bevington narrated those ghostly stories. Sophia Salaby produced them. Coming up next on Second Thought turns from the spiritual specters to zombies.
They're coming to get you, Barbara.
Stop it! You're ignorant.
They're coming for you, Barbara. Look, there comes one of them now.
He'll hear you.
Can you see me right now?
Yeah, I can see you. You're surrounded by walkers. That's the bad news.
There's good news?
No.
We'll learn about the real life events and origins of these ghoulish creatures. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is a special Halloween episode of On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. This year marks, with blood and guts, the 50th anniversary of Night of the Living Dead, the zombie flick that gave new life to the undead and to a pop culture genre.
They're coming to get you, Barbara.
Stop it! You're ignorant.
They're coming for you, Barbara. Look, there comes one of them now.
He'll hear you.
Zombies first staggered onto the screen in the 1930s, capturing the cultural anxiety of the Great Depression. Since then, they have been mainstays in film and television.
But the history of zombies far outpaces the popularity of The Walking Dead. It's grounded in dynamics of race and gender and power. Here with a primer on this history is Sarah Juliet Lauro, assistant professor of hemispheric literature at the University of Tampa, as well as an author. Her book, The Transatlantic Zombie, Slavery, Rebellion, and Living Death, explores the transatlantic slave trade as the historical center of the zombie narrative. Sarah, thank you so much for being here.
It's my pleasure.
Well, that is such a big title, and I found researching this topic so much zombie-related academic literature. Your book, of course, also Race, Oppression, and the Zombie, essays on cross-cultural appropriations of the Caribbean tradition, Zombies, a Cultural History, Generation Zombie. The list goes on and on. How did this pop culture phenomenon become a college course or series of courses in zombie studies?
Well, I think that my interest in the zombie really came about after I started seeing this incredible surge of popularity in terms of zombies. And I'll just give you what I think is the most signal example was the zombie walk phenomenon that started around 2003 and really just caught on like wildfire and started to dwindle around 2008. But it was the phenomenon where people were dressing up as zombies and showing up in public, often completely unrelated to Halloween, in May, in June, all year round. And I thought, what is happening? Why is this imagery resonating so deeply with people right now? So I think that the other academics who studied zombies like me sort of felt that through popular culture, people have a means of speaking in a kind of different language, a language of symbols, and that something was happening at the turn of the millennium, and we followed suit to study that phenomenon.
What do you think it was? I mean, I know you've done a lot of study on it, and it may not be easy to summarize, but your headline thought on that.
I think I can summarize it, actually. So there are a lot of other scholars, and everybody has an opinion. Some people say they think it was deeply related to 9/11. Other people, a very popular idea is that it has to do with economic downturn, especially because, as you noted, the first surge of zombie popularity occurred in the 1930s with the Great Depression. It could be something more amorphous, like the change from the millennium and just a general sort of dissatisfaction with the way that humanity was headed. I personally think that there was a lot of different things happening at the time, and that generally we gravitate towards the imagery of the zombie when we feel disempowered. If you just think at its most simple form of the zombie as a living corpse, because as I study, especially before it became violent, before it became a cannibal, before it became contagious, the zombie was really just a dead body that had been raised from its grave by a witch doctor. And so that is just such a symbol of disempowerment. It's life continuing to slog on in a really disempowered state. So I think we as a culture, and I would say, you know, it really was a worldwide phenomenon, so it must have just been something in the air throughout the globe, felt sort of that the people in power weren't listening to us, and that's why the zombie was so popular at that time.
What were those early zombie films in the 1930s?
So that first wave of zombie film really came out of, historically, the U.S. occupation of Haiti. There was a political occupation of Haiti from 1915 to 1934. And as a result of that long period when we had troops overseas, a lot of people were coming back from Haiti and writing memoirs, telling stories of dead men working in the cane fields, as William Seabrook wrote in his book, The Magic Island.
Whoa, and that's chilling.
Yes, it is chilling. And that's exactly the reaction that Hollywood directors had when they sort of started coming across this material, whether it be in a sort of pseudo-anthropological text like Seabrook's or Zora Neale Hurston's, or whether it was in just these autobiographies from Marines who had been stationed in Haiti. And the idea that that there was this folkloric figure of a living corpse in Haiti was something that immediately Hollywood just grabbed onto and said, oh, this is something, we can make good with. This is chilling, exactly as you said. So that first wave of zombie cinema still very much keeps to the original mythology. There's still voodoo implied. There are the corpses that are raised are very powerless. They might, in some of the films, turn against their master, but they tend to be feeble. They're a far cry from the millennial zombies that we have that are fast, that are scary, that are tearing flesh away with their teeth. So the whole story of how we get from that first disempowered zombie in 1934 to the truly terrifying zombie that we're haunted by today is a very big subject, too much to tackle in this conversation, but it is something that I've written about in my book and that other people, as you noted, have written about as well.
So it really caught on during a deeply anxious time in American history, the Great Depression, we both noted, where people weren't really sure where their next meal was coming from, and the entire country's future was in flux. So besides being this creepy folkloric figure brought from elsewhere, what did zombies do to kind of capture that cultural feeling of anxiety?
Well, I think the directors were the first zombie film directors were very savvy and saw the resonance that this figure could have. So although the original iconography in those books would depict zombies working in the cane fields, as I said, agricultural zombies. They transposed them, even in the very first film, White Zombie, you see zombies working in a factory. It's a sugarcane mill, but the imagery that would resound with an audience in the United States who might feel like, oh, I see a similarity here between the way I feel when I'm on that factory line doing the same mechanized gesture over and over, and these zombies who are laboring beyond their own death.
What did they look like?
So the zombies in the original films often were dark-skinned because many of them were set in Caribbean islands. But one thing that I've been especially interested in picking apart is the way that we whitewashed zombies very early on. Those early zombie films were always usually about the fear that a white person would be zombified. Zombies were just a phenomenon occurring on this Caribbean island, and you have white protagonists who end up stumbling across this phenomenon. But then there's a threat to whiteness and often white femininity, where a white woman is in danger of becoming a zombie. And so that will be the central plot around which those early films pivot. So the other thing that I find fascinating is that those early zombie films also quickly begin to decolorize not just the victims of zombification, but the perpetrators. Sometimes this is very difficult to see because the zombie masters, it's sort of unspecified whether they're meant to be a Creole, which was a person of European descent who grew up in the Caribbean, or whether they're meant to be European. But increasingly what you see is white people who have taken command of black magic, and they are the true villains. So I like to say you have this sort of, it would be funny if it weren't also kind of sinister, you have us take a mythology that was from Haiti that was deeply about the transatlantic slave trade and the people's struggle against slavery and for freedom, and you have it become almost immediately in its uptake into American cinema about the threat against white people by other white people and with white people coming in to save the day.
We're speaking with Sarah Juliette Lauro. She is our resident zombie scholar today on this Halloween special episode of On Second Thought, learning about the deep cultural and historic roots of the zombie, which has become so popular in our culture. Well, I'd like to hear more about that idea of the transatlantic slave trade. The zombie lore, which started in Haiti, was that carried from African belief systems or myths?
I believe so. So this is obviously this is one theory because we don't have the kind of paper trail because this is an oral history. But in my book, I sort of expound upon my theory and tracing these breadcrumb trail back to the west coast of Africa. There, I found in a late 17th century text that was recording sailors' narratives as they returned from the West Coast, sort of what would be the Angola and Congo region of Africa, recounting a mythology of soul capture, which to me is very similar to the zombie as it becomes. It's basically the idea that there are some witches or sorcerers who will steal your soul and force it to labor after death for eternity. This is exactly the form that we come to see the zombie take in Haiti. So my theory is that it was born out of probably not just that mythology alone, but kind of in the cauldron of the Caribbean and the slave trade, which brought together African people from, you know, various places on the continent. The mythology really solidified in the Caribbean around the time of the Haitian Revolution, and then wasn't really transmitted outside of it until that first wave in the early 20th century.
You mentioned the concept of the witch doctor and the depiction of that in the early zombie films, controlling the zombies so their lives were not their own.
Zombies? Yes. They are my servants.
This soul killer takes men from their graves to be his slaves. His instruments of terror, and now this fiend plots to possess a woman.
But that shifted over the years. Why do you think that narrative thread got lost in the telling of this story?
I think it's one of the sort of the easiest things to see. On the one hand, I think it kind of merged with a Frankensteinian trope that was already really legible to film audiences. So in the witch doctor kind of becomes the mad scientist in a lot of films. And so you have a mad scientist raising the dead and they're zombie-like, or he's borrowing from voodoo mythology to raise the dead. And there's that's sort of one fork in the road. And then the other one is that around the time of the Cold War, when you have a large spate of movies in the 1950s that are sort of low-budget B-movie horror. And in that period, the zombie becomes very abstracted to a kind of it's not under the control of any one person, but it's an unintended consequence. It's some sort of fallout from a technological advancement. And I think that it's very obvious to see that that was about concern with technology and science, that somehow we as humans had overreached. In terms of what we were capable of was sort of outpacing our moral development. I mean, that's pretty much articulated verbatim by a character in Ed Wood's film Plan 9 from Outer Space, where you have aliens raising the dead. So the zombie there becomes a little bit different. It's much more about space radiation. It's more about a kind of technology someone's developing to combat the Russians, as in a film like Astro Zombies. And it becomes more amorphous.
So zombies begin to mirror what is going on in our cultural cosmology, for lack of a better word.
Absolutely. Absolutely, they do.
And then later in the Cold War, George Romero's dead films, the genre begins in 1968 with Night of the Living Dead. And besides kind of creating a world building for the zombies, it's also a really interesting historical artifact, because this was the same year Martin Luther King Jr., Robert Kennedy, both assassinated, Civil Rights Act passed. And when the struggle for racial equality permeated conversations and thinking in America. So then you get a film in October, black protagonist who's protecting a terrified white woman from this plague of zombies.
If we have to, we can run in here and board up the doors. Won't be long before those things will be back pounding their way in here. They're afraid now.
And in the end, it is not the zombies that get him, but he's shot by a group of white men. Now, George Romero said Dwayne Jones, who played the lead, just happened to be the best actor. Do you think fans are wrong to make this into a commentary on race and equality?
Oh, no, absolutely not. I think, if anything, that story just speaks volumes about the way that there isn't really an author, that popular cultural artifacts are something that they almost speak through a person who's creating the text, that these things are all in the air. And almost, I like to say that George Romero was haunted by the zombie. He may not have been thinking when he made that film that it had anything to do with slavery. But I feel that the vibration was there. Obviously, he had seen those movies. He was tapping into the same kind of language in terms of revolution that the earlier zombie films were in tune with. And it's it's almost like it just came through over the airwaves. Whether or not he intentionally wanted the film to be political, it was obviously political, and that's why the film is so beloved. There were many zombie movies in the years before that that had similar aspects that were, I mean, obviously it's a wonderful, wonderful film, but it was the right time, it was the right place, it was the right ingredients to just be a political bombshell.
I'm speaking with Sarah Juliet Lauro. She's from the University of Tampa, and we're talking about the history of zombies. After the break, we'll talk more about her research and more about the significance of zombie culture in America today. This is On Second Thought and a special Halloween episode. Virginia Prescott with a special Halloween edition of On Second Thought. Up next, we're going to learn about a few Fox Theater visitors who never left. And hear some tall tales about UGA students who got adventurous and did not live to regret it. But first, we're continuing our conversation with Sarah Juliet Lauro from the University of Tampa about the origin of zombies. She is among a growing field, I will say, of zombie scholars and author of The Transatlantic Zombie, Slavery, Rebellion, and Living Death. There is, Sarah, a lot of debate about cultural appropriation and what belongs to whom? What kind of Halloween costumes can you wear? What are the dynamics of power involved in cultural borrowings? And you told us how the zombie story came about through slavery and colonial occupation. So does the zombie story help us understand or even complicate ideas about cultural appropriation?
It complicates them in a way that I feel is so revelatory and so important. And I'm really glad you asked that question. So when I was a young graduate student going to Haiti to write this book and excited to be in the culture that the zombie came from, that was basically my thesis for the book, was look at the way that Hollywood culturally appropriated this imagery, which is so important to you, and reshaped it and made it about ourselves. I was astonished by the reaction that I got from Haitians, and this has completely helped me to change my thinking about actually so many things. So here's what I learned in Haiti. Haitians said, "How dare you think that you culturally appropriated us? We have invaded you. We are so powerful that you couldn't help but be enchanted by our mythology." And I thought that was so incredible. And it just was a great reminder of the way that power never works one way. If you feel the need to culturally appropriate a symbol, it's because it has some kind of power for you.
It makes me think of how ethnocentric we are indeed, even about questions of appropriation. And the invasion idea is so big. Back in 2011, the CDC posted a series of articles called Preparedness 101, Zombie Apocalypse. And the person who wrote them, a Rear Admiral, Ali Khan, he was the deputy director of the National Center for Emerging and Zoonotic, if I'm saying that properly, infectious diseases. So this guy knows something that we don't. How likely is a zombie outbreak?
I wouldn't put any money on it at Vegas.
Well, do you think that scientists have appropriated that part of popular culture, what, to communicate to the masses? Is that what it's about?
I think it's a convenient tool. I think that zombie preparedness is a good way to talk about preparedness for other things that might be too painful to actually think about, like a mass shooter. If we're kind of trying to look into the future and think what's going to happen now in the field of zombies, I wouldn't say that zombies are going to step off the silver screen and out of the television set and into our real lives. But I do try to guess at what the next evolution in zombies is going to be. And I have to say, I'm I think it's going to be zombies who can wield guns. Mm-hmm. Historically, it's been very rare that zombies can use any kind of tool other than a rock or a club that they might happen to pick up. But I think we're so plagued right now by these epidemics of mass shootings that I would be really surprised if someone doesn't make a zombie narrative soon that's about zombies getting their hands on guns and just wielding mass destruction.
I'm thinking about the zombie popularity reaching a crescendo in the late 60s and early 70s and then dropping off in the 80s. So what was happening culturally that kept zombies in their graves at that time?
That's a great question. I'm not sure I have a satisfactory answer for you, except that I do think, I mean, there are ebbs and flows. A lot of people think it just has to do with trends in popularity. But I really go back to the fact that in the new millennium, it was undeniable that there was a resurgence. There was a zombie boom. And I think that once we had sort of bigger fish to fry as a society, it became less popular to dress up as zombies and go out into the public sphere. For example, I think that, you know, most recently, a lot of those same people who were dressing up as zombies in 2006 have been actually just going out in their regular clothes and protesting on the weekends. Or they've been, registering people to vote. They've been actually acting out politically, whereas the zombie is kind of this placeholder for me for political action. The zombie is an image that's most resonant when you feel unhappy, but there's not a darn thing you can do about it. So I think right now we're in a mode where obviously people aren't happy right now in this country for a variety of different reasons, but they're not feeling disempowered. They're feeling like there are steps that they can take. My personal prognostication is that if we end up feeling that democracy is no longer working, that our votes are really not being counted, that we really don't have a say in government, that the people we send to Washington to vote how we want to vote are just doing their own thing, I think we're going to see another zombie rise en masse.
So that's a jump. The idea that rather than people being like George Romero, living in this culture that is permeated with zombies and they just pick up the zombie thing, that they were actually dressing up as zombies as some form of protest?
I do. I think it was almost like a practice for a protest. It wasn't an active protest. It was sort of, I think I called it a dress rehearsal for protest. It was saying, you know, if we wanted to, we could organize, we could show up here at a specific time and place, and there would be thousands of us. So it wasn't a protest. It had no commentary. It had nothing actually that to say, these zombie mobs. But now, and nowadays, I feel like people do have things to say, and they're finding a variety of different ways to express themselves.
I wonder if on your trips to Haiti or reading those early accounts, those journals brought back from Haiti to the U.S. from soldiers, best scary story that you've heard in your studies?
I don't know if I have a best scary story. I think the most surprising story I have is that I was speaking with a practitioner of voodoo in Haiti, and he said that he had been contacted by NASA, that NASA wanted him to give him the secrets of zombification to use to develop hypersleep. And that sounds crazy, but if you actually think about what the zombie is scientifically, it makes a lot of sense. It was a series of different poisons. One poison to give the appearance of death, so that the family members would be tricked and bury them in their graves. And then another poison to keep them in sort of a drugged up, half alive, half dead state where they could only follow simple instructions. I personally think that it's only just arrogant to think that zombies aren't real. If Haitians are saying that this is a technology that they own and that they are capable scientifically of raising people from their graves, then I accept that.
Thank you so much, Sarah Juliet Lauro, for speaking with us.
It was my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Sarah Juliet Lauro is author of The Transatlantic Zombie, Slavery, Rebellion, and Living Death. She teaches hemispheric literature at the University of Tampa. This is a special Halloween episode of On Second Thought. Jeffrey Kilpatrick is a UGA lecturer who delves into the darker side of the imagination. Hometown Horrors, Terrifying Tales of Athens, Volume 1, Bloody Boulevard, is his collection of scary stories. One of these terrifying tales revolves around two University of Georgia students who wanted to learn more about a cult in town named the Inner Circle. And from here, Kilpatrick himself picks up the tale.
Carlos and Ben are two undergraduate students from the university, and they're friends. They're just hanging out at Automatic Pizza. All their friends are out of town. Town's kind of dead. Athens dead. It's a game day, but it's an away game. So they're just trying to come up with something to do. The waiter, you know, has been listening to them talk about what they want to do, batting around some different stories, and the waiter's like, well, I got one for you. Waiter at Automatic says, hey, why don't you go over to Old Pal, check it out. There's a cult there. Old Pal's a bar, a neighborhood bar, there across the street on Prince Avenue. So the Inner Circle is a group of old men that from Athens and surrounding areas that get together once a month, generally under the full moon, and they conduct some sort of ritual. Tends to involve blood, tends to involve a rare drink that they've concocted. And the highlight of the drink is that they have a white olive that they soak in red liquor. The liquor soaks into the veins, which makes the olive look quite close to being an eyeball. According to the stories, the drink is supposed to make you stronger, make you see in the dark, that kind of thing. Now, whether or not that depends on if you're part of the cult or not seems to be in question, because members of the cult that do have the drink seems to have the reverse effect on them, kind of paralyzes them, essentially. So they kind of lose control of their body. Their head starts spinning. They don't lose consciousness, but everything else becomes unusable. What ends up happening is Ben and Carlos, they don't interrupt the ritual that's going on, but the cult basically takes advantage of them, gives them the drink. We see this mostly from Ben's point of view, but it did not have a good effect on him. Head starts spinning, kind of starts hearing voices, weird things start happening, like wood starts to melt, and basically he loses control of his body. Everything becomes paralyzed, but he's still conscious, so he's still able to see what's going on. Then we find out they may have done the same thing to Carlos, most likely did the same thing to Carlos. We see him lying on the floor. He's missing an eye. The cult likes to take the eyes out of their victims, and they have a little fun with Ben in the sense that Carlos came in earlier. They apparently did this to him and then made Ben eat the eye of his friend. It does not end well for Ben. He does not get initiated into the cult, but he also doesn't make it out of the bar alive.
In a city bursting with new construction, older buildings hold more mystery, and some believe more ghosts. The Fox Theater in Atlanta opened in 1929. According to local legend, some of those who entered under its bright marquee never left. This time of year, the theater hosts ghost tours, so we sent producer Sean Powers to learn about the spirits that refuse to get off stage, even after the curtain comes down.
If you have a ghost app on your phone, go ahead and turn it on. If you see it working, don't tell me till the end of the tour. My name is Anna Seaton, and I'm a tour guide at the Fox Theater. That's the organist. You're going to hear strange noises coming from in there. There really is a live person at the organ. All right, so let's start with the beginning of what was here with the property. Now, I'm not going to go too far back. I'm going to go to the Civil War. 1863 to 1864, this was Fortification K. We had 25 fortification areas in Atlanta to protect us. So if there's Civil War history here, then that means there's going to be Civil War death here. We're going to probably have some ghosts from that time period, and we do. We have a soldier that sometime is seen in one of the upper windows when people are out on the street and happen to look up. Instead of lingering in the light of the lobby, let's go down where there's dark places to explore. This elevator is original to the Fox Theater, 1929. It's in Otis, and it was the first automated elevator in Atlanta. Now, I had heard that there was a ghost that rode on the elevator we just rode on, and somebody told me 6th floor, somebody told me 7th floor, but you press a button to a floor and it goes to one of those 2 floors. That's kind of a curious thing, and that it smells like roses. And I have no experience with that, and I make it a policy not to talk about the ghosts around the elevators or on the elevators, because I've had them pull pranks on me. Either that or it's a mechanical malfunction that happened 4 times in a row, you know? This is the freight elevator. Everything that's going on the stage that comes off the alley is going on this elevator. It jiggles a little when it starts connecting. When we get up to the top, we're going to go off at stage level. So I want to tell you what to expect. When the theater is empty, we're not doing a show, it's considered to be dark. When it's dark, there's a ghost light on the edge of the stage so nobody falls off. There's nobody here, but we leave a light on anyway. Now, the story behind that is you don't want a ghost to take ownership of the theater and start doing malicious things. And so you have a ghost light there to tell him it's not okay. You also have a ghost light there on other theories to show them where they can perform. My favorite recommendation on a ghost light is to have it there so I don't see them perform.
Okay. Oh my gosh.
These are your organ pipes on either side. Bob Van Kamp's ashes are in there. They're in an urn.
Bob Van Kamp played organ at the Fox for years and mentored current theater organist Rick McGee. Sean found McGee, who says he remembers Bob Van Kamp well in front of his organ.
I would work with Bob, and he'd show me different registrations and things that he would do, and I would incorporate that. You could sit and listen to him play for hours, and your ears didn't get weary. I mean, he was first the music and then the instrument. And so he's the one I patterned most of my playing after because he's the one I grew up listening to. I haven't seen Bob here. I feel like I talk to him all the time, you know, and a lot of times when I play things, I'm sure he's up there listening, going, can feel him helping you along, and it's just fine, you know.
When you eventually pass on, would you ever want to haunt the Fox Theater?
Well, I sincerely hope that maybe I can join Bob and some of them here, and, you know, maybe we'll start a whole club, you know. But, oh, yeah, I have no problems hanging around. I mean, it's fun to stay here and mess with folks.
We want to say a big thank you to those of you who chimed into our Facebook group conversation about horror films to watch this time of year. Contrary to box office trends, not a lot of horror fans among you. Catherine Knapp Kina posted, "Most of them too scary for me. I skipped joining in the fun at the Historians at the Movies this week because the movie was The Witch." She later added that Rosemary's Baby and The Exorcist made her lose sleep. You can add your horror or not story to our Facebook group. Join in the conversation. And that is it for today. On Second Thought is produced by Elena Rivera, Leighton Rowell, and the Raven Taylor. Tyler Morris is our engineer. Don Smith, our dean of grammar. And Amy Kiley is our senior producer, who happens to have a birthday today. Happy birthday, Amy. You can join the conversation again. We're on Facebook. We're on Twitter at OST Talk. Or you can email us at onsecondthought@gpb.org. Thanks to Stolting Media Group for its Halloween sound mix. Hans-André Stamm performed the organ work in today's show. It's Bach's famous Toccata and Fugue in D minor. I'm Virginia Prescott. Thanks so much for listening. Be safe out there. And from everyone on our team, happy Halloween.